Hello, I'm Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, and I'm inviting you to join me on season 3 of my podcast, Duchess. In the show, we explore the most historic homes of the UK and Ireland and meet the inspiring women who lead them. This is Duchess. Gloucestershire, a county of Cotswolds of green field, a county where rustic music, bucolic life continues to thrive in grandeur, a county where quaint stone villages showcase the charm and beauty of the English countryside. Cirencester is one such town that epitomises these words, and sitting right in the centre of it is a grand home with a historic pedigree, Cirencester Park. On one side, Cirencester Park is guarded by the tallest yew hedge in the world. And on the other, Cirencester Park faces an extensive 3,000-acre woodland where a herd of fallow deer roam free. Originally a Tudor Jacobean mansion, the home has stonework that seems to glow golden in the sun. And there's a strong sense of taste and symmetry that ruminates throughout the house's design. But this sense of taste is no surprise when you become acquainted with the family that resides here, the Bathursts. For generations, they have been at the forefront and centre of British society, contributing a huge number of civil servants, politicians, and distinguished military personnel to Great Britain. Countess Bathurst, the latest in a very long line of hugely inspiring women to live at Cirencester Park, is my guest for today's episode. She is the current custodian of Cirencester Park with her husband, Alan. In the episode, I learn about the tornado of a woman who called Cirencester her home. Countess Bathurst informs me about the many remarkable treasures they have here on the estate. And we hear the amusing story when the Earl of Bathurst accidentally chased Prince William. Thank you, Sarah, for joining me. Great to be here.
It's an absolute pleasure. I've been really looking forward to this, actually.
Have you?
Yeah, really.
We duchesses and countesses, because you are a countess as well as a lady.
Yeah.
One would imagine that we meet all the time.
We don't.
We don't.
I think we've met once, actually, maybe twice.
And but that would be at one of the Historic Houses Association meetings.
Possibly polo or possibly a charity do in London.
Yes. So the Bathursts have been a hugely significant family in British history. Could you tell us, Sarah, about the history of your family?
It's a wonderful history. I mean, they came originally from Sussex. The original name of the family was Bathurst and it changed to Bathurst. And they fought in the civil wars on the wrong side and had all of their lands taken away. All of them have been politicians. They were all, you know, most of them went to Oxford and trained at the bar. Sir Benjamin Bathurst had three sons, Alan, Peter, and Benjamin, and he bought them all an estate each. First, his eldest son, Alan, who became the first Earl. This is Cirencester Park, which is where he lived, Sir Benjamin, until he died. The middle son was Peter. He bought him Clarendon Park, which is now no longer in the family. But interestingly enough, the younger son, Benjamin, he bought Lydney Park in the Forest of Dean, and it's still in the family. Rupert Bathurst, Viscount Bledisloe, now lives there. So we call them the cousins over the hill.
Oh, how lovely.
I know Rupert, he's a very talented artist. We're incredibly fond of Rupert and Shearer. The first Earl and his father, they designed this wonderful parkland and all the sort of the extraordinary rides that, you know, the Broad Avenue that runs for 5 miles from Cecily Hill up to Sapperton. And, you know, and Alexander Pope was a great friend, and there's Pope's Seat, which is one of the follies up in the park. And then Jonathan Swift was a great friend of the family. And I always wonder if, you know, that wonderful saying, running circles around somebody. Well, Jonathan Swift was an incredibly antsy, very active man, and he could never sit still. And the first Earl was quite methodical, and he'd walk slowly through the park talking about his trees and what they were going to do. And Jonathan Swift literally used to run circles around him in frustration because he wasn't walking quickly enough. But the third Earl was incredibly interesting. He was Secretary of State for War in the Colonies, and there's a lot of places named Bathurst around the world, and they were named after him. And for instance, New South Wales in Australia, there's a Bathurst, and that was the first inland city stroke town in Australia. So they had all the sort of the ports, but they hadn't sent anybody inland. And Governor Macquarie, who was the governor of New South Wales at the time, sent off his prospectors and expeditionists and said, find somewhere where we can settle inland, and for heaven's sake, name it Bathurst, because you know who signs the checks back home. And that's basically what it was. And he was the one who put Napoleon in a way for his natural in St. Helena. And if it hadn't been for the Third Earl, the Battle of Waterloo would have never happened.
Goodness.
Because in government and in parliament, they were saying, look, you know, all these spats that Wellington's having with this Napoleon. And he, the third Earl, who was quite a shy man, didn't particularly like speaking in public, made a marvellous speech and said, look, we've got to put this little Frenchman back in his box. Otherwise, he's going to be a thorn in our side for quite a long time. And they said, right, we'll fund this. And that was the final push on the, of course, the amazing victory at Waterloo. And Wellington and Bathurst were huge friends. And he came down here to visit quite a lot. We've got the Duke of Wellington room, actually, where he used to stay.
So have we.
Have you? Really? Yeah. How wonderful.
Because Beaver was being built.
He obviously got about.
Well, he was very friendly with the Duke and Duchess. He was known as the Iron Duke, I think, wasn't he?
Yes.
And the fifth Duke and Duchess had a whole suite of rooms for him at the castle. And I found, when I was doing the retail village below the castle, this wonderful plaster moulding of the Duke of Wellington's head. I thought, oh, that's amazing. I must put it in the gardens. So I put it in the gardens. And of course, it wasn't made for outside at all. So
of course, it didn't melt.
No, it hasn't melted quite. I found an inside spot for it, but I've had a bus made that sits in our gardens.
Oh, wonderful.
And is under one of the Wellingtonia trees.
Oh, wonderful. I've got two heirlooms, which I love because they just make me laugh. And it's a bust of Wellington in the big dining room, which sits on a piece of elm, which was the only tree left standing on the field of the Battle of Waterloo. And Wellington had it brought back and had various artifacts made and gifted them to various people who had been important in the campaign. And he gifted this beautiful marble bust of himself sitting on a piece of elm from the Battle of Waterloo. But at the other end of the dining room, we've got a bust of Napoleon. And it just makes me laugh because if they could talk, I wonder what they say at night. I hate you. I hate you more.
Well, that's very interesting because David's desk, he has an extraordinary chair.
Right.
And it's made out of the very same oak.
That's amazing.
So they definitely would have known each other, our ancestors.
Definitely. Well, you see, but they would have done. But you've got these wonderful parties, haven't you? They had the house parties in those days. We don't have time to do that because we're so busy keeping the places going. But in those days when, shall we say, life was slightly less stressful, they were able to go around and see each other much more.
Tell us about your childhood and your background.
Well, funny enough, I was born in Marlborough, which isn't all that far away. I used to tell people when I was a child, I'd go up to people and startle them and say I was a moonraker, which I thought was a wonderful story. But then I was brought up in Dorset. My family sort of HQ was just over the border in Devon. So I was brought up in Lyme Regis. And I just had a very happy childhood, went away to school.
Did your family have an estate, Sarah?
No, they didn't. No, 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 no. My father used to farm and then he married my mother and she decided she didn't like pigs. And so that all finished. And he went to work for Leavers as a consultant for chicken farms.
Oh, and my father was a chicken farmer.
Really?
So we have.
Oh, I wonder if they met. That would be so exciting.
So he farmed for a company called Sun Valley on the Welsh borders.
But really?
Did you have something to do with books?
Yes, we were a very booky family. Always, always have been. My grandfather was a doctor of science. He could build a radio from scratch, which was amazing. He was an incredibly clever man. So I think it probably got diluted as it went down the generations. And they ran out of brains when it came to me. But he had five children and he was the headmaster of Newton Abbott School, which is why my family moved from Derbyshire down to Devon. And they've always been very, very booky. And so when my parents got married, they started off with antiquarian books and then went into new books. And so we had a little string of bookshops down in the southwest.
Well, how did you meet Alan?
Funny enough, it was a blind date. I was down in sort of Dorset, Devon. I had some friends down there who had a brother and sister-in-law. They went down to stay with these mutual friends and I met them and had a lovely time. And then a couple of months later, they rang up and said, it's our first wedding anniversary. would you come up for lunch? There's somebody we'd like you to meet. He's going through a rather unhappy divorce and we're trying to think of nice young ladies to introduce him to. So goodness knows how my name came up. But we went up and at the toughest goose I have ever had to, you couldn't even cut it. It was like leather, but it was great fun. And I met Alan, didn't even know who he was until about halfway through lunch. So I met him and we got on really well. But he was seeing somebody at the time. And so I went back down to Dorset and we sort of loosely stayed in touch. And then about 6 months later, I think the following June, I went to a wedding in Buckinghamshire and funnily enough, caught the bouquet, which must have been a sign.
Oh, wonderful.
And 2 years later, I met Alan and I'm absolutely convinced, because he is completely my soulmate. I mean, we were quite clearly meant to be together. We knew we were going to get married after 3 weeks of getting together.
How would you describe the experience of marrying into such a family and a home?
A revelation. A revelation. A lot of people have got a preconceived idea of what it is to have this life, and it's nothing like those preconceptions. It's hard work, but it's really enjoyable and it's something, it's a passion, you know. It is a way of life. These estates, these houses are a way of life. They're not a job. They seep into your soul and into your being and you become as one. It becomes part of you. You become part of it. And I think that it's really important to always have a respect for the past, an eye on the future, enjoy your days, but just, you know, crack on and make the best of it that you can. And yes, you're going to make mistakes. I mean, my goodness, I probably made some absolute howlers in my time, but I'd like to think that the good stuff outweighs the bad.
Did you come up against any opposition to you in the early days? Did you find there was anyone who you didn't feel supporting you, Sarah, in your job?
I think when a new girlfriend turns up, people are always a bit, oh, hello, what's all this about? But frankly, I think I would have fallen in love with my husband if he lived in a sheep shack. So, I mean, I remember when we met for the second time and he said, please come back to the house for a drink. And we drove down the drive and saw that, and I saw the house for the first time. And it was all I could do not to turn my car around and get the heck out of there as fast as I could. I thought, blimey, this is a bit sort of much. But that would have been really rude. So I didn't. So it's, yeah, there were people who I think probably were slightly sort of, you know, looking at me out of the corner of their eyes saying, what's she up to? But I think that when you know it's right, isn't it?
You've had some amazing women in the family. Yeah. Tell us about, you've got a Violet. I've got a Violet.
She's actually Viola, known as Viola, and she was Viola Meeking. And she was my husband's grandmother. And she was a tornado of a woman and very strong and really respected. And she had the two boys, Henry and George. And she did all sorts of volunteering work during the war. But very tragically, in 1930, she came off a horse when she was out hunting and broke her back and was confined to a wheelchair for the rest of her life. And even more tragically, in 1942, her husband was coming home from Malta to see the children who'd just come back from Canada. And they crashed on takeoff and he was killed, which is absolute tragedy. And he was MP for East Bristol. And she took over his seat and campaigned in Parliament. And she was quite a lady. She made the speech from a wheelchair.
Goodness.
I know. And she was powerful, wonderful, powerful woman. And also very passionate about Sarah and Sister, very passionate about the house.
It feels to me as if we may have a room of ladies in here supporting
you. I think so,
you.
I'm sure.
Coming back to the present, Sarah, how would you describe your role on the estate today?
Supportive of my husband, running the house, getting involved in the charitable work, running my little coffee shop. But because the estate is in trust, the actually running the estate is not an avenue open to me. So I do other things. And I think that that's healthy because, you know, my husband, who's lived here and worked here for his entire 60 years, this place runs through his veins. He knows what he's doing. This estate would not run without my husband. He is the most amazing man. And I think that because you've probably realized I'm quite strong and I'm quite single-minded, I just don't think that it's terribly healthy for me to get closely involved with the running of the estate. We've got a very good team in the office and a CEO. And if I was to start meddling, I think that probably it would cause a problem. So my role on the estate is to be supportive to my husband, is to be a public face of the estate and to do the community things, which I completely love, run my little business. We've got holiday cottages on the estate, but also next year to wait when we open up for weddings.
Amazing.
And to run those.
Is it open to the public, Sarah Chester Park?
Well, no, but thereby hangs a question because we are going to start doing weddings here. You know, this is a big house, it's expensive to run, and it's a really, really beautiful place. And we had a little wedding here last year and we had so much fun doing it. And they just loved being here and having the lovely big garden to play in. And, you know, they wandered up to the lake and it was absolutely gorgeous. And so we thought, actually, we could do some more of this, you know, because there are things that I want to do here. And speaking earlier, before we started recording, this is an old house and it's got some very old pipes in it. We are one of the houses that if you haven't run a bath for a while, when the water comes out, it's bright orange.
I've got that problem.
Yeah.
Lot of lead as well.
Yeah, a lot of lead.
But the park is open to the public.
The park is open to the public and has been since day one, since
1695. And you'd have how many people go round your park a year?
Would you know something? Thousands.
Yeah.
It's lovely. It's in people walk their dogs. And I started off a little coffee shop and it's called Beano. And I started it off in a horse box 3 years ago and it's now in a vintage Airstream. And so people stop off and have a cup of coffee and a piece of cake and talk to my lovely girls at Beano. And we have huge fun up there.
Oh. Could you describe, Sarah, for a moment, the room that we're doing this fabulous interview in today?
This is my favourite room in the house. This is the library. For obvious reasons, being from a very booky family, I'm surrounded by beautiful leather-bound books.
The wallpaper looks as if it might have gone on when Cirencester Park was built. It's
the,
so fabulous.
The wallpaper is leather-stamped. It's listed. And I know it was designed for this room and for the family because it's got little nods to the family coat of arms in its design, which nobody noticed before. But I also love the atmosphere in this room. I always feel when I walk in this room, there are people in it. I find myself saying, hello, everybody, it's only me. I've come in to do such, such and such.
What I adore so much about speaking to Sarah is the warmth and deep sense of pride she imbues in everything she does. Sarah radiates enthusiasm and joy for heritage. Since we began Duchess, the podcast, so many of you have reached out expressing the wish to make listening to Duchess a reality. We adore making this podcast, but we know nothing compares to experiencing these beautiful places for yourself. So, for people who want a once-in-a-lifetime experience, we've partnered with the award-winning luxury travel company Abercrombie & Kent to bring our much-loved podcast to life. From guided tours, stays in grand rooms, fishing trips on the family lake, to private tours of beautiful gardens, our partnership with Abercrombie & Kent will enable you to experience Duchess, the podcast, for yourself from Inverary to Beaver and beyond. With Abercrombie & Kent, you can come and stay, visit and explore the houses that are featured in our series Duchess. Our partnership with Abercrombie and Kent will enable you to experience Duchess the podcast for yourself with your own tailor-made itinerary. For more information, visit abercrombiekent.co.uk/duchess. We'll put a link in the show notes. This is just a quick reminder that you're listening to Duchess, hosted by me, Emma Rutland. And this is a podcast produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. Coming up in the podcast, Sarah brings us through beautiful gardens on the estate, and we hear about the time the Earl chased Prince William down the drive. But first, I wanted to learn more about the splendid designs and interiors of Cirencester Park. Could you walk us through some of the different styles and designs as we walk through the interiors?
Yes, I can. But except for three rooms, I've redecorated the entire house. And so it's sort of my taste. But I love warm colours. And I think when you've got larger rooms, you can get away with warm colours. So I love burgundies and reds and greens. And I love sort of heavy curtains and squishy furniture.
Can you tell us a little bit about your magnificent collection of paintings?
We are incredibly lucky. We've got a very large collection of Peter Lely, but we've also got some beautiful de Laszlos, which we managed to attain back when my stepmother-in-law decided to leave them out of the family, but we managed to get them back. And they're incredibly important because they're of Lilius and her husband Seymour, and also Viola and her husband Alan. So my Alan's grandparents and great-grandparents. So it's very special to have them back. Aww. We've got some beautiful paintings. The Duke of Wellington, of course, by Lawrence, is hanging in the hall. And one of him is Stride Copenhagen, is a very famous painting. And we have a lock of Copenhagen's mane in a little frame, which I keep very carefully because obviously don't want it to disappear.
And you don't have to be open at all to the public, Sarah?
We don't, but I do tours. The Historic Houses Association coming in, various sort of historical groups like to come around, and I always do it because I love talking about the family history, and so I always do the tours.
But just to explain to our listener, one of the reasons that these houses originally with very, very high tax, I think in the sort of 40s and 50s, that they couldn't actually pay the inheritance tax on the houses.
No.
And so, for example, on the death of a duke at Beaver, we do a negotiation with the government to talk to them about what are the needs, because we can't afford to pay the entire tax.
Mm.
And so that is renegotiated each time there's a death.
Yes.
And on my father-in-law's death, we negotiated to be open to the public for 30 days a year, and we're open for way more than that, but also to open our private rooms.
Yes.
And then that reduced the tax bill. So I always say it's a total partnership living in heritage with people.
It is, and I think it's really important to share it because, you know, there are some really important stuff here. I mean, we've got sort of the second Earl was the Lord Chancellor, and we've got his purse here. I mean, it is the most extraordinary thing. And I think it's lovely to share our heritage with other people because, A, why have you all got to keep it to yourself and, you know, hide behind your arm and say, don't anybody come in? But I love showing people the paintings. I love talking about the family history because it's incredibly interesting. And I think, you know, you've got to share that because it keeps it going. You know, it's got to be the continuation.
There's a very famous group of columns. Is that right?
There's a lovely group of marble columns in the front hall, which I think it was the second Earl bought back. From Vienna.
Yeah. And that was happening just about the same time as Beaver was being built.
Really?
And so what's fascinating is how they brought all those things over.
Yeah.
You know, can you imagine how in 1814...
I mean, those things are vast. That's 100 men having to carry one of those things. I mean, they are fantastic. And these collections, I also think it's really important because, you know, we do have these amazing historical things around us. But I think it's really important to add to it in our lifetime too. And so, you know, we've got a couple of things that have added to the collection. And I think that everybody should do that.
As we sit here in Cirencester Park, we are right in the centre of Cirencester.
Isn't it amazing?
With that extraordinary hedge.
Yeah, I know, so smart. Pevsner is very unkind about this house and he says it's not terribly pretty, but I think it's beautiful. But the first Earl, when he bought it in 1695, bought it for its landscape, and he and his son loved landscaping.
Cirencester has a history of fantastic gardens. Yeah. Tell us about them and how the history began.
Our garden, it's not a garden with walled bits and massive borders and, you know, beautiful flowers. And we got one border, but our garden was meant to be part of the parkland. So when you look out of this window, you see a vast lawn in front of you with some beautiful Wellington trees, which I completely love. It grades then into the park. So this is sort of a natural progression. And that was always the idea of Sir Benjamin Bathurst and the first Earl, is that the garden would integrate with the park. And so the home park, which is at the end of the garden, which has now got our beautiful Gloucester cattle in, which we love, also used to have deer. And of course, the estate used to be a deer park too, but the walls fell down and they escaped and they're all over the place now and they're gorgeous and I love them. And we've now got roe deer and fallow and muntjac, which my father always used to say looked like they'd just been kicked out the backside. The estate is known for its amazing follies that the first Earl built. And we've got one in the garden, which is the temple garden, but there's, you know, Pope's seat, there's the horse guards, they're all over the place. They're beautiful.
Is it true that it had quite a few famous admirers of the gardens throughout its time?
It did. Jonathan Swift, Alexander Pope, Rudyard Kipling was a great admirer and used to come here a lot. See, the thing is, it's sort of because it's the estate being 15,000 acres, it covers quite a lot of ground. And it's not just the gardens here, but it's the parkland. But there's also some other really special places on the estate. And one of them is Pembury Park. Park, which my husband's great-grandfather used to go to on holiday. Well, at least you didn't have to go very far if you forgot the teaspoons. I mean, you could just pop back. But it was because they'd have a smaller staff, and it meant that staff here could have a bit of a holiday too. And that was a beautiful garden, raised. It's the house, and then the garden comes across and drops down to a sort of a path, but it overlooks the most astonishingly beautiful valley. And it's got the yew tree walk.
Oh, the yew tree. And
which is haunted.
Is it?
Yeah.
Why?
None. A nun.
A nun.
Mm.
There you are.
But the other thing is that we do boast the actual source of the River Thames on the estate.
Do you?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's very special.
It is very
and
special.
And is it running? Is the source still very strong?
It doesn't. Sometimes it's wet and sometimes it's not.
So do you have a favourite part of the garden, Sarah?
I do, the lake. I love the lake. There are 580 ducks and two swans, and I go and feed them every day, fastidiously. And they do this wonderful, one of them sometimes gets so excited to see me, it honks and it throws back its head and it does this sort of honk, 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 and then it puts its head down and it does this purr, which sounds like a chainsaw.
Like a purr.
It's really gorgeous, and it sort of it gives me shivers. So I go up, and that's my favourite place, because being brought up by the sea, I do miss it. I really miss the sea. I'm also Cancerian, so my natural thing is water. And so to have the lake and just go up there and be able to sit, that's my downtime. I go up there and I sit and I think and I talk to the swans.
Oh. What is the secret, do you feel, of a great British garden?
The secret of a great British garden? I'll tell you exactly what the secret to a great British garden is that it brings its owner happiness. So a garden can bring happiness to somebody if it's got nothing in it. I mean, one of the most beautiful gardens I have ever been to is at Highgrove. Every corner you walk around, there is something extraordinary there. And it is done with complete love and passion by the Prince of Wales. And it brings him happiness. So that is a beautiful garden. Our garden is beautiful because I can walk up it with the dogs and just think of the history and look back at the house. That brings me happiness. The secret to me of a good garden is the happiness it brings its owner.
I think that's the nicest reply I've ever heard, and I will certainly remember that. So staying on the ground, Cirencester has a very royal and proud history.
Yes.
To do with polo.
Yeah.
Could you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, the Polo Club has been going since 1894. It stopped during the war, but was bought back by my husband's uncle George. It's just a really beautiful polo club. Ivy Lodge Grounds is well known to be the best polo grounds in the country, possibly the world. This is wonderful Cotswold brass, you see. It drains, keeps enough moisture to make it like velvet, but then it doesn't get too soggy.
So you must have had some amazing members of the royal family come to play polo here.
Yes, we have. Going right back in time, the Duke of Windsor played here a lot. And then going on, we've obviously, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales has played here a lot and loves it, and so have Princess William and Prince Harry. But we've also had the Maharaj of Jaipur and the Sultan of Brunei. We've had some amazing people playing here.
And any wonderful stories that you can share with our listeners about the royals, and anything funny that's come across?
Oh, my father-in-law did have a bit of a, well, actually, I think it was probably well covered in the press, actually. Prince William was wanting to get home, I think, rather quickly one day, and drove a little too fast down the exit road, and my father-in-law took particular exception to that, didn't care who he was, and stopped him, but then was surrounded by his PPOs, and it sort of all got sort of a bit awkward. But Henry didn't care. I think he said, I thought it was just some oik, which always rather creased me, because I thought that's not an oik as William. But they were very sweet about it, and I think that he realised that probably wasn't the thing to do. But Henry was, he had his photograph taken the next day in his pyjamas and dressing gown, standing by his white Land Rover Discovery, looking very pleased with himself. I just thought the whole thing was very funny indeed.
Oh, how hysterical. Our Prince William story, and it's lovely if you are lucky enough to meet the royals in person, because yes, you realise how incredibly grounded and
they are wonderful
and so devoted to the roles that they do, and I'm sure there's no question from any of our listeners to that.
Yes.
But we had a shoot on the Beaver Estate. And one day, some people were arriving in a helicopter. And we'd no idea who they were. But just before they arrived, some two burly men in black suits and looking as if they've got sort of holsters around their waists came into the kitchen where my once was nanny, who then became the cook on the shoot, who was one of those nannies that absolutely got our children sorted. She tamed these baby lions for me. And she was in cooking roast pork for the lunch and preparing, you know, sausage rolls before they went out. And Phil came into the kitchen and said, "Caroline, I hope you've got the roast going because you've got Prince William joining us today." And she said, "Why don't you off?" "I'm the queen." In came Fantastic. Prince William, and he spent the entire day, which is magical, jumped into Phil's filthy truck with him and went round the entire shoot all day and was so interested, so knowledgeable, and actually, you know, a joy to have with us. And so yes. If we've had royal stories, they sort of will be written up in our archives.
I know, I'm sure they would.
What other ambitions do you have for Cirencester Park in the future?
My ambitions for the estate are for its safety and retention. And the estate is doing quite a big development just outside Cirencester, which I hope will very much sort of make it financially solid for a few generations. But I mean, my ambitions for the estate and the house is just to maintain its history, to add to it, make it as rich as one can in sort of just information. And I'm not saying in material things, but in information, but also to encourage, you know, future generations to take on the mantle and appreciate it with a deep appreciation and gratitude for the history of the family. And it is vast.
What would you say to those women, six generations in the past, when you sit here in this wonderful library?
Oh, I wish today I could talk to them. Wouldn't that be so much fun? I think that I would thank them, first of all. I don't know what I would say to them, but I would love them to tell me about them. You know, because they were extraordinary.
And what about just moving forward to the lady that is sitting here in your chair in six generations on?
What would I say to them?
Yes.
Be kind, be generous, protect it with every ounce of your energy, and do as much as you can for your community and for the estate. And don't get big-headed, and don't let it take you over. Remain your own person. Keep your own friends. Have your own interests. And don't let it swamp you.
And Sarah Bathurst, you will be sitting in this room, let me tell you, looking over her to make sure she is behaving.
And if she doesn't, I'll be chucking stuff across the room.
What an exceptional lady you are.
Aww.
And how lucky is this house having your love, your passion, your kindness, and your energy.
Aww.
And every room that I've witnessed has got your love in it.
Aww.
So well done, Sarah.
Thank you so much. Well, well done you too. I think what you're doing is amazing because you're opening up the doors of these stately homes and you're giving the ladies of the house a voice, but also to be able to share their experiences and their knowledge and actually, you know, trials and tribulations, but successes. And it's just wonderful. I think what you're doing is wonderful. And I am now going to listen to all of your podcasts.
Oh, thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Cirencester Park. It's been a wonderful journey down here and learning about this history. And we will definitely stay in touch.
No, let's. And you're always welcome. And thank you for coming.
I adored visiting Cirencester today for so many reasons. The history here is fascinating, the home so beautiful, the landscape so serene. But most of all, I adored speaking to Sarah herself. She beams with so much pride for her home and her heritage. Cirencester Park sits right in the centre of this town and its community. And what becomes clear when speaking to Sarah is that community sits at the heart of everything she does. Thank you so much, Sarah, for joining me on the podcast and sharing your wonderful home with me. And thank you as well, everyone at home, for listening and being with us on this occasion. Next week on the podcast, I meet the wonderful Mrs. Claire Watson Armstrong of Bamber Castle in Northumberland. In the episode, we learn why Bamber is considered one of the greatest archaeological sites in Great Britain. We are introduced to some of the many ghosts that are said to still walk the castle turrets, and we learn the history of one of Britain's great inventors. We'll see you there. So now, my dear listeners, last season I asked you to write to me, and that in every episode we would share them on the podcast. Responding to your messages has become one of my favourite things about the show, and we'll be doing it again throughout this season. So please do write to me at duchess@duchessthepodcast.com. This week, we have a very, very special message from Eve in New York City. The message reads, "Dear Emma, the Duchess of Rutland, my name is Eve Bell. I'm 8 years old and from New York City. I am a big fan of Duchess and British accents. I love hearing the story of famous houses and castles. I practice my British accent all the time. Sometimes I only speak in a British accent. Like on Christmas, I only spoke in a British accent, and I think I did a good one. Lastly, when I practice my British accent, I always say, 'This is Duchess the podcast.' I loved the Christmas special with Eliza. Is she the daughter who doesn't like spicy food? Fondly, Eve." Well, thank you, Eve, for that. What a charming letter. And I almost feel you've got to come here and show me your very own British accent. I'm not so sure about spicy food and Eliza, but I'll just have to check that one out. There are just a few quick notes before we go. Make sure to follow Duchess wherever you listen to podcasts. One of my favourite things about the podcast is learning more about you and hearing your stories. So please write to me. Tell me about your own lineage and share with me the women who've inspired you in your life. You can write to me at duchessthepodcast.com. You've been listening to Duchess, the podcast presented by me, Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, and produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. From Beaver Castle, Lady Violet Manners is the executive producer. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kasra Ferruzia is the audio and visual engineer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Additional creative support from Selena Christofies and Theo Banner. Thanks for listening to Duchess, the podcast.